This is an SGA McKay and Shepherd podcast. It is mature and maybe at times explicit. Favorites, written and read by Jenna Coma. Rodney was agitated. He hadn't touched John in 9 weeks and 3 days, and John seemed okay with that. Rodney wasn't really sure, but he reasoned that John was trying to be sensitive to Rodney's frustration as the least favorite parent, because it wasn't just a sable like John Moore. She hated Rodney, or so he deduced from the fact that she screamed like Rodney was ripping out her adorably teeny fingernails whenever he held her. Sable, at 2 months, had already decided she liked John best, and Rodney was livid. He couldn't take it out on the baby, so John, naturally, became his target. But Rodney's tactics of withholding affection had backfired long ago. He snapped at the physicists, berated the Marines, and viciously attacked Keller's pediatric skills if admonishments from Taylor, Woolsey, and John were any indication. She was crying in her beer on a balcony off the East Pier, Rodney. It's not her fault. It's totally her fault that she's a horrible doctor. This thing with Sable, she's helping me. First, she's not helping you. She's cooing and playing with Sable. Second, she's a hack. She couldn't figure out what's wrong if she wanted to. I miss Carson. We all miss Carson, but Dr. Keller is a good doctor. So stop making her cry, you dick. And that was the nicest conversation he'd had concerning his abuse of Keller. Woolsey droned for 28 minutes about how the Atlantis community had to learn to respect everyone and their profession, while Taylor beat Rodney during a suddenly mandatory Mantos training session. He still had the bruises. But Rodney accepted it all because he knew that it wasn't Keller's fault that his daughter didn't like him. It was John's fault, and that's why John was being punished. Except, John seemed perfectly fine with the status quo, as tension-filled and sexless as it was. It was Rodney who was suffering so much that he realized he needed a new plan, because it was almost impossible to stay mad at John Shepherd, especially when John was trying to be nice. "Come here, Rodney," John said, then sang, "Rodney," which finally made McKay look up from his tablet across the room. "You gotta see this." And Rodney came reluctantly because he did want to see what was so amazing about Sable at that very moment. "Check this out," Shepherd said, dangling the plastic keys in front of Sable. Immediately she reached for them, palms patting John's chest when he held them out of reach. "She's developing depth perception. She's tracking, John." "She's totally tracking, and almost 3 months early." "What did I say? She's a McKay. She's going to be a genius." "All right now, don't get carried away. We don't want to pressure her with high expectations." "What? Are you crazy? That's exactly what I want to do. Nobody rises to low expectations, John. What, you want your child to be an underachieving botanist or something? Or if she wants to be military," John wondered, just egging Rodney on at this point. "First, what father would ever want his daughter to be constantly in harm's way? And second, no fucking way. Sable will absolutely not be wasting her considerable brain power on guns and ammo. It's bad enough you're doing it." "Why, Rodney, that was almost a compliment. Does this mean you're through with giving me the cold shoulder? I mean, Sable not crying with me is probably something genetic. She's the first kid Atlantis has made in 10,000 years. Maybe her wires got crossed. Or maybe my Dean got the closest thing to the ancients, right? Yes, yes, I know you have the strongest ATA gene, and no, I'm not done blaming you just yet, Rodney snapped, taking the plastic toy from John and smiling down at his daughter, who cooed in delight. Okay, so I should keep taking cold showers. Definitely, Rodney said, glad for the proof that John was, in fact, suffering, albeit in relative silence. He let the colonel off the hook. Soon. Ronan watched from afar. It was nothing new. Ronan always watched Shepard. This time, he watched Shepard sneak up behind McKay on one of the lower terraces and whisper something into the scientist's ear. McKay did his, ha-ha, very funny, Shepard, voice, but Ronan could see McKay was smiling. Ronan sighed. He hated to see his closest friend suffer, but Rodney was still playing games. Ronan had been keeping his distance for almost a month. He would not stay away much longer. The Satine smirked, still amazed that Meredith Rodney McKay had bested him twice in the mating ritual. McKay, Ronan thought, had no idea. He had no idea that Ronan had claimed John first. The first night Ronan spent on Atlantis, under heavy guard, the Satine had bonded with his new leader, and while their mating served the purpose of dedicating himself to the service of then-Lieutenant Colonel John Shepard, Ronan had thoroughly enjoyed the ritual. He had explained to Shepard that it was the Satine way. Warriors pledged their lives to their leaders through physical devotion. Usually, once was all that was required. But Ronan was considered a beauty by Satine standards, and Kale was a possessive taskmaster. That Kale was so lavish in his affection for Ronan made the taskmaster's betrayal so much more wounding. Ronan told himself that his revenge was for Satita and his brothers in arms, but most of it was for himself. He thought Kale loved him, not like a mate or a child, but perhaps like a younger brother. Now, after years of fighting next to Shepard, Ronan knew what real love was because their friendship was better than even the commitment he had shared with Malena. At first, Ronan would tell himself it was all happenstance. Shepard had changed his life, had given him a home, and had been the first to touch Ronan after years of being an untouchable runner. So Ronan chose to commit himself to Shepard because he was stupidly grateful, and he had nothing better to do. It was after they had shown him what was left of Satita, and Ronan was devastated, staring at the walls of his guarded quarters, when Shepard made the offer. Look, Ronan, I can't change what happened, but I just thought I could maybe help you take your mind off it for a while, Shepard said, walking to where Ronan sat against the wall, his knees drawn up so that his elbows rested on them. Shepard sat next to Ronan, who smiled gamely when the smaller man nudged him. In seconds, their limbs were entangled as they rolled across the floor, tongues tied together. Ronan held John down and licked inside his mouth, withholding the passionately violent kisses they had been exchanging until John began to buck to regain control. That first time, Ronan fought John, but Shepard refused to give in. In the end, Ronan allowed himself to be rolled over and stripped half-naked for the grinning man who had saved his life. He waited on his knees in the darkness, listening to Shepard undress, Ronan thought, until he felt cool, slippery fingers rub against him, then push inward. No, Ronan growled. Just do it. And Shepard decided if he wasn't allowed the gentle caresses, he would have some connection. He flipped Rodan on his back and looked the Satidan in the eyes as he pushed in one steady thrust. At first, Shepard didn't move. Then finally he said, "Okay." Sounding as if he was composing himself, and the Satidan made a sound that was half laugh, half groan, and completely yes. Shepard's ragged breathing above Ronan suggested it wouldn't last, but it felt good just to be touched again. And when John stroked that sudden burst of pleasure, Ronan grunted in surprise and John laughed, doing it again. The involuntary snap of Ronan's spine in response was intoxicating, and when John could feel himself about to let go, he reached down to find Ronan hard and wet between them. Ronan's abrupt shout startled both men just before pulling Shepard over the edge and lighting up the walls of the darkened room with iridescent bursts of color. Shepard rolled to his back next to Ronan and they watched the light play across the walls and learned how to breathe again. It had been many years since Ronan had experienced such pleasure, and he recognized Shepard's deprivation. "How long?" "Too long, since I've been in Atlantis." "But you have all your men here." Ronan seemed confused. "Yeah, well, our military doesn't really appreciate sex with soldiers under your command. In fact, there are rules against it. Basically, my only choices are the scientists, who generally think we're dumb jocks, and the people we've met in the Pegasus Galaxy, and McKay gives me so much grief about them that it's hardly worth it." Even though Ronan didn't know much about McKay, this was enough of a warning, but Ronan was too blissed out to pay attention to John's words. Ronan had had many leaders and taskmasters, but John Shepard, he knew, would be his favorite. They made no promises, but shared secret moments throughout each day. The next week, when McKay and Catman got mixed up in the dark, Shepard was preoccupied, and even after the scientist and the Marine were separated, it took Ronan cornering the colonel to drag Shepard from his stupor. The sex was still good, but less frequent over the next few months until it stopped altogether. By then, Ronan had other lovers, though none shared the same connection he had with Shepard. But Ronan had come to understand that it was McKay his leader wanted. Ronan didn't understand why, but he watched them together and could not deny the happiness he saw on Shepard's face or the laughter he heard in his leader's voice, even when Shepard argued with the physicist. Ronan could plainly see there was no physical connection, but he respected Shepard's unspoken wishes and understood Shepard's attentions were not easily divided between two. Now, it had been years since McKay and Shepard had been together, and McKay had been angry for weeks. Ronan watched Shepard suffer in silence until he couldn't stand to see Shepard's frustration. They were sparring when Ronan took Shepard down with a foot sweep and straddled him. "This is not good for you. You should take him by force and be done with this childish game he plays," Ronan suggested, pinning Shepard's wrist above his head on the cool surface of the mat. "Well, yeah, but that would be rape, which is kind of frowned on in our culture." "He will give in." "We're talking about McKay here, right?" was all John said in response, but his body was responding as well. He was stretched out in only a sweaty t-shirt and track pants and held down after a vigorous workout so that his body was a bit confused. Ronan leaned forward and whispered, "I can help." Then licked John's ear, which got an immediate response that the Satidan could feel against his thigh. hey, I appreciate it, buddy, but I can't. Not now. Roman understood. He barked a laugh and rolled off, gathering his equipment as Shepard composed himself. We done? Shepard asked, but Roman didn't even spare him a glance. Later, Shepard, he said, walking out the gym. Not today, but soon, Roman knew. Soon. I was captured when the Wraith called Satita and found myself on a hive ship when the Wraith started feeding on me. I made him stop. From the moment when Shepard heard Ronan's account of how he became a runner, he knew he had to have the warrior on his team. The attraction was immediate. Shepard vividly recalled his arousal at being tied in a cave facing his giant captor. He hadn't imagined the heat in the man's eyes, but when Taylor spoke, he remembered himself, stopping short of propositioning the beautifully rugged man. Even Taylor's wiggling fingers were dangerously arousing. What the hell are you doing? I'm getting my hand free. Doesn't feel that way, Shepard muttered, wishing only he were captured and bound in the cave with the hot alien. He immediately trusted this fellow soldier and wanted him in more ways than one. The interest he saw there was unmistakable, and Shepard tested this theory when they got back to Atlantis. He knew he wanted the lonely Satitan to stay under his command, and if that were to work, Shepard couldn't afford to let the bigger man top, despite how much he wanted to submit. But what Shepard could offer was friendship, a place to belong, and an end to both their longing for touch. He thought for a moment that this was selfish, that maybe he was the Lothario Rodney accused him of being. But then Roman was fumbling on the floor with him, snarling, "Just do it!" And Shepard knew everything would be all right. The next few months were filled with the best, most athletic sex John had ever had. They were both very discreet, so John had no worries about gossip. Only Taylor had any idea because Taylor knew everything, and she and Ronan had their own bond as the only Lantians from Pegasus. Shepard didn't think Ronan would confide in her, but she gave Shepard amused and approving looks when she saw them eating or sparring together, and once even said, "Ronan Dex has proven himself to be a great asset." With a knowing smile that Shepard tried to ignore as they watched the Satitan abuse the Marines for sport. But John worried that he would get carried away, so on missions, he never paired himself with Ronan, always with Rodney. Late at night, when most of the city was sleeping, John would visit Ronan and convince Atlantis to temporarily soundproof the quarters for a few hours. Then, he'd wake Ronan and force him to run 5 miles through the city, and Ronan would groan but comply before abandoning Shepard for a warm shower. John was happier than he had been in a long time, and everyone seemed to notice. But that spot of joy was tempered with an overwhelming concern for McKay, which seemed to start almost immediately after Roman came to Atlantis. If asked, Shepard knew it started immediately after he had to shoot the dart carrying McKay and Catlin out of the sky. At first, his worry for McKay was out of a concern for the city, or at least that's what he told himself. But it quickly became much more than that, as if being with Ronan reminded John of what he really wanted from his worrisome genius. Months later, he was still running with Ronan, but there was little else between them besides friendship and loyalty. Shepard had returned to near celibacy with the occasional mission-related interlude with Rodney, Ronan, and even Taylor once or twice. He had cherished each time he was close to Rodney, but he could hardly base a relationship on alien ritual sex on the job. Still, it opened the door to a few half-drunken make-out sessions on the darkened East Pier, and they had forged just enough of a casual physical connection for John to feel jealous and a little bitter when McKay flirted with Esposito, who was totally into Ronan, and Katie Brown, who would have married McKay if he had nailed the proposal. And that was okay. John could live with those occasional distractions, but Keller was different. McKay seemed to really like her, even though they couldn't be more mismatched in Shepherd's opinion. McKay's romance with Keller made John angry. From her sentimental refusal to allow the team to take McKay to the healing cave, to her constant attempts at improving the masterpiece that was Dr. Meredith Rodney McKay. Keller was just all wrong for Rodney, and everybody could see it. "I think I told her I love her." "What? When?" "When I was losing my memory and making all those videos," Rodney confided one day soon after the recovery from the parasite. John just gave a half smile and patted McKay on the back, hoping to himself that Rodney wasn't thinking of proposing. John didn't know what to say, but he knew what to do. Rodney. He would be with McKay every chance he could get, preferably having sex. But eating lunch or racing cars through the halls of the city late at night was almost as good. He just wanted Rodney to himself. He could finally admit that. When McKay took Keller back to Earth as arm candy, Shepherd told himself he spent more time with Rodney than Jennifer did, and he knew they had more sex, even if their relationship was more of a secret. It wasn't until Keller decided to leave Atlantis after declassification that John and Rodney's relationship became an exclusive thing. They didn't talk about it, but they spent most nights together for almost a year before Sable came along and made them a family. John loved Sable like any father would love his child, but he also loved her for giving him Rodney, who would always be his now that they shared this new little person. Even if McKay withheld kisses, shower blowjobs, and beer on the pier, John still slept next to his best friend every night and never failed to wake up entangled in Rodney. So yeah, it was frustrating because John loved sex and Rodney was a genius at everything, sex included. To be denied pushed John to masturbation, but afterwards he washed his hands, went back to the family room, sat next to Rodney, and watched Die Hard with a Vengeance with Sable asleep between them. Life was better than it had ever been. Of course, that was when John started having dreams about Ronan. They were on a mission, walking through a dense forest. It was only Shepherd and Ronan coming down a steep hill, but John knew there had been many more men. He didn't know what had happened to them. After a long struggle through the dense brush, they made it to a clearing where they left the jumper. Ronan got there first and pulled his blaster, searching for the enemy. "What?" Shepherd hissed, immediately drawing two guns and getting his back to Ronan's. They walked in a circle, both doing a 180 together as they scoped the layout. It felt like a familiar dance, and that was nice. It only took a minute to know they were alone and free to stare at the crushed ruin that was their jumper. Now, John knew, they would never make it home. When Ronan stood against John's back, it was for comfort more than lust. At least that's what John told himself when he woke up humping Rodney's thigh. "What the fuck, John?" Rodney snapped, jabbing John in his post-mission tender ribs.
Hmm?
John moaned. The next couple of times dreams disturbed him. John caught himself before Rodney violently woke him. The morning Rodney kicked John out of bed, John yanked on sweats and trainers and took off to the less populated part of the city. John was uneasy. It wasn't hooking up with Ronan that disturbed him. Not mostly, anyway. There was an odd feeling to the dream that made it seem like more. There was an ominous feeling lingering even as John ran through the deserted catwalks of East Atlantis. What happened to the other men? What happened to the jumper? He thought of all the upcoming missions while he ran. There was PX-497, where they would search for the possible ancient storage facility, Peralta, with whom they had trade relations, and PN-93, with whom they wanted to trade produce. None of these were scheduled within the next week, and none of them were thought to be dangerous. John put the disturbing dream out of his mind, making it back home in time for Sable's morning feeding. The cranky morning whimper met John at the door. He walked through the darkened rooms until he reached Sable's, and then the walls glowed dimly, leaving John to wonder if Atlantis was being helpful or if he had annoyingly turned on the walls. In the Athosian-crafted crib, Sable squirmed with stuttering cries until she saw John peer over her. Then Sable belted out a wail that had John rushing to get her in his arms. There was a loud thump followed by half-muttered swears. Sable's breath hitched, then she screamed louder. John smiled. Two rooms down, Rodney rolled out of bed and hit the floor knees first. Shit! I shattered my kneecaps! Rodney winced before stumbling to his feet, ankles tangling the sheets and making him struggle to stay upright. I'm coming! He groaned. He shuffled blind through the pitch dark, but stopped short at the doorway. He heard the gentle, vibrating whine Sable only made when she was being bounced by John. Rodney squinted sleepy eyes to stare at his best friend's lean back, swaying left and right with a gentle jiggle. He sighed, turned back down the hallway to fetch a warm bottle, and thought of how he just hated John. Rodney most certainly did not think about how much he loved John's big pointy ears and how he sang Danny's song slightly off-key. He did, however, decide just maybe John, who had been on almost constant Sable duty, deserved a really nice blowjob, at least. In the morning, John was a little tired, but he was used to it. He could feel Sable crying herself to sleep in her crib, and Atlantis showed him McKay gently rubbing her back with a grimace John knew meant he had a headache. McKay would stay there, John knew. He would stay until she cried herself to sleep. Colonel Shepard, you are needed at the command center, Woolsey said. On my way, John said with a lazy drawl. He sighed, but immediately walked in that direction. Where are you headed? Ronan asked, joining Shepard as he marched through Atlantis. Something's up. Woolsey sounds all squirrely. Squirrely? John just smirked and nodded, not bothering to explain what he meant, which was fine because Ronan didn't need an explanation. When they arrived, Woolsey was glad to see them both, or at least didn't object to Ronan hovering in the corner with his arms crossed. The Belkans went to these coordinates and haven't been heard from since. It's known to be a habitable planet, but the people are nomadic. They suspect the trading mission didn't go well, but we've been asked to determine the truth. Understand, I'm not asking you to engage the enemy. In all honesty, we don't know there is an enemy. The choice is yours, Colonel Shepard, but we owe it to our allies here in the Pegasus Galaxy to check this out. Of course, I suppose this is dangerous and difficult despite the fact that you can't verify any enemy. We'll talk to the scientists, Shepard said, effectively dismissing Woolsey, who promptly disappeared into the background. He looked to Amelia, who explained the situation. The gate is inside a cave, and once you clear it, you'll be about 10 kilometers away from what the ancients called the Blazing Way, which basically sounds like a river of fire coursing through a rainforest. Of course, in the jumper, you'll be able to easily cross over the river to get to the trading post. Okay, so river of fire, check. Any other reasons this is any different from our average mission? We'll leave immediately. Shepard called Lorne, who sent a team of 6 to accompany Shepard's shrinking team. Now, it was more often than not just Shepard and Ronan. Taylor was still part of the team when she was free, but her official role, as IOA saw it, was as ambassador, and this kept her away much of the time on negotiations and goodwill missions. Initially, Colonel Shepard had accompanied Taylor. They were a team, and this was a mission like any other. Then, more vital missions came, and Shepard knew it had to be his team. So they had lost Taylor mostly, and when Sable came, Rodney was totally lost to the team. John had reluctantly agreed that Sable needed at least one parent, and the likelihood of both of them dying on a mission together was too high to allow McKay to be anything but anxiety-ridden, so he stopped going on missions. Officially, McKay stopped going on missions with Colonel Shepard, but he could admit to himself that he never wanted to go on missions without Shepard. Technically, he was still on the off-world scientist list, and the list was short, so no one was taking him off it. Out of deference to Colonel Shepard, though, none of the higher-ranking officers had added McKay to any team. McKay hadn't thought about it because he was busy taking care of Sable, but he was definitely planning to go on missions again, despite the fact that he knew Shepard expected him not to. Now, Shepard rotated 2 soldiers whenever he went on missions. This time, Lorne had assigned 6, so Shepard had 2 teams waiting for him in the jumper bay. He found McKay in his office, feeding Sable, who was swaddled in one of Shepard's old button-downs. McKay looked at him expectantly, pointedly saying nothing as he eyed Sable, who was whimpering. He shushed her, turning away from John so Sable wouldn't see him. "I'm headed out," John announced to Rodney back. "Where? You're not scheduled for a mission until next week." "I know, but some Belkan traders went missing and they want us to check it out." "They? Where? Do they think it might be Wraith?" "No, the Wraith are gone, or at least in the deep sleep." "So, just a look around? Is that all the United Pegasus Coalition demands?" "Exactly. Be back for dinner." Ronan knew immediately where they were. Shepard may have ignored the Satidans' brooding before they left Atlantis, but now that they were through the gate and soaring over a river of white-hot phosphorus, Ronan's glower seemed more important. "Problem?" "Not safe here. They should go back." "You've been here before. What do you know?" "There are beasts as large as the Daedalus. You wouldn't even be a snack," Ronan joked. But from the memories behind them, Shepard knew the Marines hadn't found it funny. Shepard grinned. "So we should have brought the missile launcher?" "It's really nice to see you concerned about our welfare," Shepard said, looking back at his team as he sat the jumper down in a small clearing. "Who's concerned? I just thought I'd warn the kids." "Let me get this right. They're in danger, but we're okay." I got your back, Shepard, Rona said before rising and walking down the ramp leading off the jumper. Shepard followed. He broke the 8 men into 4 groups and sent them in different directions with instructions to go search for the Belkans and return at 1400 hours. You know we won't find anything, Ronan said. What makes you so sure? Either they've been eaten or they've been taken in and hidden. Either way, we won't find them. Let's just assume they're alive. Where are they hiding? I don't know, that's the point. They never come out with all these soldiers. Shepard could hear the certainty in Ronan's voice, and he trusted the Satine's expertise. Ronan didn't lie or say things he wasn't sure about. When they met back at the jumper, 2 teams looked spooked but had nothing to report besides huge piles of droppings. It was another team that had the best news. They found a camp which was abandoned in a hurry. There were leftover tents and cooking utensils strewn everywhere. We tracked 5 set of prints into the trees and then lost them immediately. The trading party was supposed to be 8 people, but that's a start. We found tracks too, but little else. Good job, team. Let's head back. Ronan gave Shepard a suspicious look, but boarded the jumper without a word. He didn't even mess with the big bad Marines, who wasted no time marching back into the jumper, and didn't say a word about not finding the Belkans. When they got to the gate, Shepard dived from the jumper, but landed and ordered the Marines out. Tell Woolsey and Major Lauren that we can't track them with a large group. Ronan and I will track while we have daylight. If we're not back in 24 hours, send a team to search. The Marines, who were good at taking orders, looked disapproving but didn't hesitate to walk through the gate bearing Colonel Shepard's message. Well, let's find where they're hiding, Shepard said, rising up and soaring over the river of burning phosphorus, which seemed somehow higher and hotter. Dinner time on Atlantis found Rodney bouncing an upset infant who was half-feeding from her bottle. He ventured out to the mess and found Taylor, who took pity on him and held out her hands for the baby. Torin was chirping happily in his high chair, reaching out for Sable, who was noticeably calmer in Taylor's arms. I swear she does it to spite me, Rodney moaned and retreated to find something to eat. Taylor just smiled, knowing a crying baby could be exhausting both emotionally and physically. When Rodney came back, Sable was almost asleep, and Taylor made quiet small talk to calm her friend. I thought dinner feedings were Shepard's job. Where is he? I was hoping to find him here, but maybe he didn't come back yet. He said he'd be back for dinner, Ronnie said, sounding a little resentful. There is Major Lorne, Taylor motioned with her head. She waited for him to come closer. Major, has the Colonel come back from his mission? No, I'm sorry I forgot to tell you, Dr. McKay. It must have slipped my mind. Tell me what? That he was delayed? He's always out somewhere playing hero. Ronnie dismissed it as Shepard being Shepard. Yeah, well, I still meant to mention it to you. He seemed to think he had a better chance of finding them with fewer people, so he stayed with Ronan and said to give them 24 hours to find the Belkans. Sable let out a tentative whimper as if she understood she'd be without her favorite father for the near future. Rodney sighed and tried to focus on his meatloaf special. Looks like it might be a long night. Sorry about the bad news, McKay. Lauren commiserated, but quickly walked away from the complaining baby. I thought she was almost sleeping. She understands, Taylor. I know every parent thinks their child is special, but Sable knows things. She knows when John's in the room, and I think she even knows when I'm thinking about him. I think she's empathic. McKay, babies are often keen observers of our moods. Taylor said, not dismissing McKay's concerns, but not giving them too much weight either. She'll observe that John's not putting her to sleep tonight. She knows it's his time. Maybe it will be good for both of you, Rodney. As Rodney expected, Sable slept fitfully between wailing her displeasure at having the wrong parent comforting her. He was glad to make it to morning because Sable was sleeping soundly after keeping him up all night, and John would be back soon. That afternoon, when John still hadn't returned, Rodney threatened the lives of 5 scientists, 2 psychiatrists, and every Marine he saw. Needless to say, Sable was still grumpy and her dad still hadn't caught up on his sleep. By dinner, McKay had interrogated the people working the gate room because Lauren was nowhere to be found. All McKay knew was that the search party found a crushed jumper and retreated to the gate after 2 hours of unsafe temperatures at the search site. He couldn't find Lauren, so he went for the next best thing. When Taylor found McKay, he was terrorizing the gate room techs, and Woolsey, who was trying to maintain his composure in the face of a scathing tongue-lashing from a livid Rodney Meredith McKay, Ph.D., Ph.D. Sable was strapped to his chest and wailing almost as loud as her father. You send our best defense to some hostile alien planet and then break the gate? How did you break the gate? Why haven't you fixed it? Dr. McKay, you will calm down now. You must eat, and then we will find Lauren and learn of Colonel Shepard. I'll eat when I fucking feel like it, no sooner. And no time soon, considering Shepard might be dying in the dark. Taylor cocked a single eyebrow at McKay, walking toward him purposefully. McKay cringed a little, backing up as if he thought the Athosian warrior was about to pull out her bantos, but Taylor just grabbed the baby harness. You may starve yourself, but you may not starve this child, Taylor said, and pulled Sable from the carrier, singing softly to the baby and making soothing, cooing sounds. Sable, who was red-faced and just as angry as McKay, continued her high-pitched wails of unhappiness. When did she last eat, McKay? Are you suggesting that I'm not feeding my daughter? Give her back, you're making her cry, McKay said. The room fell into silence, glad that Taylor had come and glad that someone was brave enough to take Sable from Dr. McKay. She was one of the few people who were not afraid of Rodney McKay, and a dozen eyes looked to her to address the audacity of his attitude. What? He demanded from the entire room. But that was not Taylor Imogen's way. She immediately understood her friend's anxiety. John was missing, and nobody seemed to be doing anything about it. Add to that a screaming baby, and it was enough to push any sane person over the edge. Rodney, we will find John. First, let us find Major Lorne. Then we will know what we must do. Rodney deflated and followed Taylor as she took his child to find dinner. She didn't bother to bring up the suggestion of McKay eating dinner. She just pulled the power bar from her pocket and handed it to him as they walked the halls of Atlantis. She knew Torrin would be disappointed since it was her last one and his favorite snack, mostly because she didn't let him have the chocolate too often. She smiled and thought of how John always gave Torrin secret candy bars and bags of chewy rainbow candies which she liked herself. Rodney, on the other hand, always cited Taylor's rule about not being allowed to eat chocolate as the reason he wouldn't give Torrin any, which Taylor realized was probably why John started sneaking Rodney's candy bar to the toddler behind his partner's back. By the time Taylor walked McKay to his quarters and warmed a bottle for Sable, Taylor was as determined as McKay to find out what happened to Shepard. Sable went from gurgling cries to ravenous sucking at the 6-ounce bottle, which was suddenly empty. Rodney, when did you last feed Sable?
I don't remember. I know she had a nap late this morning and she ate after that.
Taylor looked like she was going to give Rodney a scathing tongue lashing, but thought better of it when she saw how miserable her friend truly was.
Make another bottle, she said.
When McKay finally found Major Lorne, the officer explained how he was working to find a way to get Shepard and Ronan, even though the gate was malfunctioning. He thought their only two options were to find another gate address on the planet or send the Daedalus to rescue them.
Are you insane? The Daedalus isn't due back for 2 months. They can't survive that long.
Ronan is a skilled hunter, and Colonel Shepard has survived much long-term adversity, Rodney. I think they will survive until a rescue comes.
Since when does Ronan hunt in the dark?
You said this before. What do you mean? Taylor asked. We went back. Not only did we find a jumper smash, but the river was more violent and the sun was so low that it was almost dark. When we got back, we found the ancient records and learned that this is the planet's equinox.
What is?
It's going to be dark for weeks. What? McKay demanded after seeing Taylor's look of sudden recognition.
I have heard stories of the ancestors restricting use of the rings, not for punishment, as some on Atlantis have suggested, but for safety. Perhaps this period of darkness is considered unsafe in this area of the planet. Usually, there is another gate on the planet that can be used safely, if only by the ancestors. I suspect that this particular gate cannot be used until the darkness has passed.
So we're stuck with waiting it out, and in the meantime, we have no idea if they survived whatever crushed the jumper?
You got any better ideas, McKay? Lauren asked, sighing in frustration.
Of course, genius, McKay snapped, pointing to himself and gathering his supplies.
Well? Lauren asked after a few seconds.
Well, obviously we find the address of the other gate on the planet, fly in with a jumper, and find Shepard and Ronan.
There are thousands of combinations, McKay. You going to dial each one?
The gate is a computer. A high-tech computer, but a computer all the same. I can hack it.
Eventually.
Now leave me alone, McKay demanded, already scribbling numbers and symbols. Taylor and Lorne shared a look of resignation, then both backed off, leaving McKay to his calculations and plans. Rodney worked nonstop, only dozing occasionally when it was quiet, which meant that Sable had cried herself to sleep. She complained constantly, with whimpers and whining that Rodney learned to ignore mostly, but after a week, Rodney had had enough. He was solving an equation for the sixth time to the background music of whales that sounded like sirens and broke his resolve. Rodney threw the dry erase marker across the room and pulled Sable from the harness. He held her up and sniffed her diaper.
Oh, come on, Sable, give me a break here. You're dry, you've had a bottle, you're not sick. You're only crying because it's me and not John holding you.
Well, guess what, little lady?
I'm sad, too.
Only I'm doing something to get him back because we cannot live without him.
I've been very tolerant,
but you gotta help me, Sable. Give me a break or I won't be able to bring him back.
Much to Rodney's surprise, Sable's wails calmed to whimpers, and her hands touched his face like they touched John when he sang to her. It wasn't until stubby fingers touched his cheeks that he realized his face was wet. Rodney began to sob quietly at first, and then in earnest as Sable stared up in awe, patting his face in the only comfort she could give.
Now you're quiet, Rodney laughed through his tears, because Sable had finally stopped complaining. It was lucky Ronan and Shepard were able to save a few supplies. The near sub-zero temperatures alone would have been a death sentence were it not for their protective gear they salvaged and Ronan's hunting skills. They found caves when they were tired and hiked in darkness when they were not. Shepard wasn't sure where they were going, but Ronan said he was taking them to another gate, and that was good enough for Shepard for now. One dragon, 2 weeks, 3 rodents, and 6 huge roach-like insects later, and John had a lot of questions. Just how far is this gate? John asked, sipping on his near-empty canteen in an attempt to wash down the crunchy, oozing bug Ronan had called dinner. The Ring of the Ancestors is 6 days south and 3 days climb from where we started. Okay, but it's been like 12 days. When I did it, I wasn't hiking through dense forest in the dark. It's taken a little longer, Ronan explained. He was more than a little amused at what amounted to Shepard whining about how long it was taking to get home. But Ronan did his best to be supportive. After all, Shepard did have Sable to worry about, who was probably crying nonstop now that he was MIA. Ronan even admitted to himself that Shepard was worried about McKay. The Satin had no illusions about the fact that John loved Rodney, even if the Colonel hadn't admitted it to himself. He had promised to get Shepard home, and he would. Still, Ronan knew Shepard had his doubts about if he would ever see Rodney and Sable again. He avoided the conversation as long as he could, but Ronan thought it was time to fill Shepard in on the game plan. The ring has been disabled by the ancestors for the safety of travelers, but the ancients wouldn't restrict their own access. There's another ring. It's just really high. Yeah, well, I seem to recall mountains and rocks without trees. Right. We can't scale the face of the mountain in the dark. But we're going to hitch a ride. I like to fly, but I draw the line at dragonjacking. It doesn't seem like it will end well. Don't worry. Satin warriors are trained to mount all manner of beasts. Ronan laughed, slapping Shepard on the back and lounging in the cave to apparently sleep. All Shepard could think about was being cooked by a fire-breathing dragon with 4 eyes and the arms of a centipede. He thought back to when he first met Ronan and knew the man had to be on his team. It was this expertise that John had needed. Now, he told himself, he just had to relax and trust Ronan to know what he was doing. Shepard closed his eyes in the cold dark and didn't complain when a huge arm drew him closer into the warm line of Ronan's body. Ronan caressed John, his hands traced the lines of John's face, and got lost in the stuffy folds of protective gear, searching for warm, bare flesh. His mouth kissed the back of John's neck, and his hands squeezed and pinched wherever they touched. When Ronan reached his prize, John let out a broken moan and grabbed for Ronan's hands, which were doing an incredible job of stroking beneath Shepard's layers of clothing. Wait, what are you doing? Ronan just smiled in the darkness and stroked, liking the way John's hands were guiding and not stopping him. Oh shit, what the hell? Still confused. How long has it been, John? Ronan laughed, but Shepard knew he was serious. It was the same argument, and John couldn't explain how angry Rodney was almost as much fun as nice Rodney, and really, a brief period of abstinence was more than tolerable considering years of military celibacy.
and if he occasionally satisfied himself with one of the dildos confiscated from the practical joke played on the new Marines, well, that was his business. The business was a 12-inch big boy with a realistic feel of skin, but it couldn't compare to Rodney's bites and bruises and dominance. Still, John would take Rodney any way he could get him, and it was this, John knew, that aggravated Ronan relentlessly. Or more precisely, it was the fact that John only wanted Rodney. To be fair, John also wanted Ronan, which Vesetita knew and used to his advantage whenever possible. But John was at heart a monogamous man, and he wanted Rodney and Sable more. John moaned in pleasure and torment, and imagined it was Rodney breathing in his ear. He thought of his possible imminent death and the fact that he hadn't kissed Sable and Rodney goodbye. Hell, he hadn't kissed Rodney in weeks, and he got lost in the memory of the last time he had Rodney. Sable was only a week old, and Rodney had yet to fully appreciate Sable's parental preferences. It was 23 minutes of the most glorious post-feeding and diaper-changing sex known to man, John was certain. Rodney had cuffed his wrist to the ancient wall arc that served as a bedpost and began biting John's ear, which never failed to make John shudder and babble senselessly. Dragon death, only reason. Oh, geez, Shepard said, and Roman's laughter was a deep rumble in the Satina's chest. Shepard groaned and had just enough clarity left to bite his lip and enjoy the wet exploration of his ear without embarrassing himself more. When Roman wriggled his fingers, John froze. No, like this, he said, making Ronan stroke him again, and Ronan understood. Shepard would not give himself like that, not to Ronan. He palmed Shepard's hardness in one hand and yanked at the colonel's uniform with the other. When he moved the hand covering John's dick, it jerked to attention, slinging wetness across Ronan's mouth. He smirked, looking directly at John before licking his lips and inhaling the head of his cock in a fury of swirling, moist tongue. Fuck, John moaned, listening to the wet, savage noises and remembering how terrifyingly aggressive sex with Ronan always was. It was hot. Ronan could have made John come immediately, cursing and screaming Ronan's name, but he made John wait, teasing him again and again until Ronan begged and chanted his need for release and came babbling through his tears. Seconds later, John was breathing deeply and Ronan was grimacing as he readjusted himself and closed his eyes, liking the idea of Shepard owing him one. He would let John rest. McKay was restless. He had spent a week doing the math, which Zelenka did not have to help him with twice. It took far too long to write the program and modify the gate room systems, especially with Wolsey breathing down his back. Finally, when McKay programmed the gate room computers to hack the gate and find the second address on the planet where the Belkans had vanished, he spent 5 days watching it work and was beginning to get impatient since Woolsey had only given him 7. They had decided it was too risky to run the program with teams still out on missions, but missions would have to resume soon. So McKay hovered in the gate room, daydreaming about when Shepard would come home. He missed waking up to the tangled limbs pinning him to the bed or the quiet humming of classic rock coming from Sable's room. It was the 6th day when the chevrons aligned and the gate opened to Rodney's shouts of victory. It worked! That's it! McKay shouted to the 2 a.m. skeleton crew in the gate room. He yelled for Major Lorne, whose immediate appearance suggested he too had been hovering somewhere and had a rescue team waiting in the jumper bay. With standing orders from Woolsey to bring back Colonel Shepard and Ronan, the team immediately flew out in a jumper with nothing but Lorne's promise, "We'll bring him back, Dr. McKay." Nobody mentioned how it was likely that Shepard and Ronan had not survived. McKay refused to entertain the thought they wouldn't bring Shepard and Ronan back. Shepard lay in pain, but he wasn't worried. He'd had far worse. In the end, Ronan's plan had worked and they were just resting before hiking the rest of the distance to the high gate. It had all happened so quickly. Baiting the flying beast with poisoned meat, lassoing it, and swinging the board at its back as it reared in anger. Ronan, of course, was adept at riding the dragon as he pulled them higher and higher up the mountain until they reached a plateau as vast and flat as Kansas fields, if Ronan remembered correctly. The dismount wasn't too bad for Ronan, who managed to land on his feet and roll a few times before finding Shepard, who hadn't rolled at all. In fact, for Shepard, it was more like a 20-foot drop, which had probably broken at least one of his twisted limbs. When Ronan grabbed Shepard's collar and pack and pulled him to the relative safety of huge boulders, he was stopped by a shout and cursing that made him smile with relief. "So you're alive." "Really? It feels like you're killing me," Shepard said. "Nah, I think you broke something," Ronan said, still walking with Shepard sliding along the ground in tow. Shepard flailed in vain until he finally made contact with the Satini's calf. Ronan stopped again. "If I leave you laying out here, the beast may decide to come back and cook you. We're close," he said, finally sitting Shepard up against a pillar from some ancient ruin. Ronan looked at Shepard and smiled. "You're a little banged up, but you'll be fine. We'll head for the gate soon," he said, adjusting the P90 around Shepard's neck into a splint for the colonel's leg. Ronan was working out how he would carry Shepard silently a whole mile to the gate without getting eaten by whatever giant beasts were lurking in the darkness, when he heard a familiar sound, and then the screeching of a great bird, and then he heard a thud. He ran to look out across what he knew to be an opening leading to the high gate, and saw a bright light moving slowly. He lit a flare and waved it around as the light moved closer. "Hold him down." "Really, I'm okay, Dr. Keller." "Wait, you're not Dr. Keller?" "Jones," the pretty doctor said with a smile, all while checking her machine and motioning for the attendants to strap Colonel Shepard down and take him to surgery. "You've got a fractured femur, and you've been impaled by some type of horny instrument." "What? What did you say?" Rodney demanded as he met the gurney on the stairs, eyeing Ronan suspiciously. Ronan grunted and stalked away from the crowd. "Oh, no you don't, big boy. I want to see you, too." "Right now, Specialist Dex," Dr. Jones ordered, sidestepping McKay and ignoring his questions about Shepard all the way to the transporter, at which point she just began to feel rude. "Dr. McKay, give me time to stabilize Colonel Shepard and I'll give you a full report. I promise," Dr. Jones said, backing into the transporter and giving orders to the doctors waiting in the operating room. Rodney would have persisted, especially since he had never really seen Dr. Jones in action. But he left Sable in her crib, and even though she wouldn't be up for almost 2 hours, he wanted to check on her and wake Taylor. 20 minutes later, McCabe was refusing to leave the med lab until he spoke to Colonel Shepard. After being told it would be at least a few hours, McCabe pulled out his tablet and began working to pass the time. "He's in recovery. You've got 5 minutes before Dr. Jones checks on him, McKay," Dr. Wiley said, motioning for McKay to follow him. Ronnie jumped up, letting his tablet clatter to the chair, and following Wiley through the maze of clean rooms until Wiley pulled back a curtain and McKay saw Shepard blinking at the ceiling.
"Rodney? Hey, buddy. It's good to see you,"
Shepard said with a goofy grin.
"John, you're alive."
"Well, yeah," was all John could manage as he gazed into Rodney's face and grasped for his hands.
"Sable?" John muttered before falling off to sleep again.
"It's fine. She's great, John. She even stopped crying. Mostly," Rodney said. His fingers combed through Shepard's hair as Shepard's eyes drifted close.
"No product, my ass," Rodney laughed as he tried in vain to achieve the artfully disheveled look Shepard loved so much.
"Dr. McKay, care to explain why you're playing with my patient's hair?"
Dr. Jones asked from the foot of Shepard's bed.
"Just fixing it. He likes it like that," McKay insisted, sticking his chin out and looking down at the petite doctor.
"Oh, well, excellent. You'd be glad to know that I expect Colonel Shepard to make a full recovery."
"Yeah, he was impaled by something reptilian, but it missed most of his internal organs. I did remove his gallbladder, but he should be feeling better in a few days. Of course, even with advanced healing from the ancients, his leg will take about 6 weeks to heal. You should get some rest now, Dr. McKay. You want to be here bright and early when he wakes up, don't you?"
"Of course I'll be here when he wakes up," McKay snapped, but allowed Dr. Jones to guide him out of the med labs and push him toward the nearest transporter. Now that John was back, Rodney realized he was, in fact, very tired, and that 0900 was a very reasonable time for visiting hours to start.
"You're up. Listen, I checked with Keller, but she says she can't really pull any strings since the third shift doctor admitted you. I think she's sleeping now, so..."
"That never stopped you before, McKay."
"I know, but she's kind of scary. Anyway, it doesn't look bad, so I'm sure it won't be too long."
"Nice try, but I was impaled. I think she's going to want more than 24-hour monitoring."
"No way. Atlantis has crazy technology.
Speaking of impaling, you being MIA made me rethink my Nookie Man. You are officially out of the doghouse." McKay played with John's hair, and John just rolled his eyes.
"You make it sound like I did something wrong."
John pouted while Rodney ran light fingers beneath John's sheets and against his arms, caressing the bend of his elbow.
"No, I was wrong, and I'm going to spend a long time making it up to you," Rodney promised, leaning over to kiss John, who puckered up and opened slightly.
"Excuse me, gentlemen. Colonel Shepard, just wanted to check on you and let you know that all of Atlantis, indeed all of Pegasus, is relieved to have you back," Woolsey said, undeterred by the makeup sex he had just interrupted. In Woolsey's defense, most makeup sex probably does not happen in med labs with patients who have yet to be released. Rodney, however, was not easily discouraged, so he kept caressing Shepard while Woolsey talked about how Major Lauren was an asset who performed well under pressure, but just couldn't replace Colonel Shepard. Eventually, after many sighs and eye rolls from both McKay and Shepard, Woolsey excused himself.
"My God, I thought he'd never leave."
"Hey, Colonel, McKay, glad to see you're all right.
You two look busy," Lauren said, standing at the curtain and backing out immediately.
"You're so perceptive,"
the case, Matt. Later, Lorne, Shepard smiled, giving a little wave as the curtains were yanked closed. Now, where were we? You were making it up to me by bringing me my daughter, who I haven't seen in weeks. I tried that, but Dr. Jones won't allow it.
We'll never stop you before.
No, but I hear she's a decent programmer, apparently. She's repaired quarantine systems which restrict access to dangerous populations, in this case, infants. It's ludicrous, but a tedious distraction to reprogram, and ultimately not worth it, since she'll probably be out of here in the day it takes me to hijack the system, so...
So how are we feeling, Colonel Shepard?
Dr. McKay is right. No babies allowed back here, but you will be going home soon as long as you have someone to take care of you, Dr. Jones said, looking pointedly at McKay. She scrolled through the tablet next to Shepard's bed.
Your charts look good, so I'm releasing you on the condition that you follow my precise instructions and come in for regular checkups, yeah?
Okay by me, Doc. Shepard sat up, trying to swing his legs out of bed.
Hold on, Colonel. We're getting you a ride.
What part of no visitors, doctor's orders, don't you understand, Zelenka? I'm not making it up. Just forget it, Rodney said, tapping his earpiece to disconnect. Sable, of course, found her daddy's ranting to be the perfect lunchtime entertainment as she lounged in the cradle of McKay's arms, half playing with her bottle and making happy, gurgling noises as she stared up at her father.
Oh, you think that's funny, do you?
Take your mutinous child, McKay demanded, settling Sable into John's lap when he saw John was up and watching Die Hard again. What's the problem? Sable giving you a hard time?
She just missed her John, didn't you? John said.
Yeah, well, she didn't miss all of your bad influences. Berber, Rodney ordered as he sat down to tinker with some gadget.
My bad influences?
Yes, it was bad enough that you were the only person noticeably happy when I'm upset and frustrated. Now Sable laughs at me, too.
Oh. I thought she was crying on you again.
Sounds like an improvement.
You would see the move from mindless wailing to hurtful amusement as an improvement.
Well, you do seem happier, Rodney, John said, still focusing most of his attention on Sable. He gave her obnoxiously loud raspberries and grinned when she dissolved into joyous giggles and baby drool.
I admit, Sable and I came to an understanding these past few weeks, which is more than I can say for all of Atlantis, who act like they don't know what no visitors means, Mr. Popular.
Are you saying I have too many friends? John asked, with that edge of laughter in his voice that never failed to aggravate Rodney.
Friends? No. Sycophants? Definitely. According to the Galactic Grapevine, you've got gifts from the Ethosians, Travelers, Genii, Hoffins, the people of PX7455, P2X374, P4M328, and of course, the Belkins.
John's only response was his signature grin.
It's not funny. It's disturbing. Atlanta didn't even tell people you were missing as a matter of security. Still, somehow, you have some weird piece of tech from the Sel'Kari and some box we think that's from that assurance sect.
The Venari? John asked.
Right. Aren't they supposed to be extinct? I don't even know what else you got, except, of course, some random gift from Proculus.
Did it come with a note from Chaya? John asked, just to see Rodney turn that flustered pink color John loved so much.
McKay slammed down his tools and sat up.
That's it. I'm going to get lunch.
Hey, don't leave. I thought you were going to make it up to me.
Look, Sable's closing her eyes. Come keep me company, Rodney.
I can't help it if people like me. Those people hardly know me. To them, I'm just some symbol.
Their favorite symbol, Rodney mumbled, coming closer to kiss John despite his jealousy and his reluctance to share, which Rodney was willing to admit was more than a little ironic,
But Rodney wanted nothing more than to have John to himself. He had missed being with John, too, and now that he had him back, not even a personal hollow vid from Chaya was going to keep him away. Rodney looked at Sable sleeping soundly on the other side of the bed and whipped back the sheets from John's legs. There was no need for subtlety as he ran his hands all over John's body until they came to rest at the waist of John's tinted shorts. He palmed John through the soft cotton, rubbing at the hard length of him. "Rodney, please," just John begged, resting his own hand on his waistband. He didn't touch himself, but he held onto Rodney's hand and rocked his hips and pleaded until Rodney froze. "Hand at your sides," Rodney said. John sighed happily and complied, letting out a low moan when he felt cool air and his shorts pulled down just enough to bear him to Rodney's touch. It only took a few minutes before John was panting and babbling and fisting the sheets. Later, when Rodney had used baby wipes to clean their mess and righted John's clothes, John pulled him in close and kissed him tenderly, which left Rodney speechless. He fluffed John's pillows and gathered himself before heading to the door. "You still need lunch. Close your eyes, and when you open them again, I'll have a turkey sandwich and chocolate cake. They have all your favorite foods waiting for you in the mess, and Rodney, huh? You're my favorite," John said, grinning at Rodney's surprised smile as the door swished closed.